Don't eat on the podcast. There's a rule. No eating on the podcast.
You've been muted, Dusty.
That away.
Come on, man.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Third Wednesday Theology on the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Coram Deo Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down and talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're discussing The Wonderful Works of God, Chapter 1, Man's Highest Good.
It's Herman Bovink Day, everyone.
Yes.
I am so excited about how many listeners have bought this book. I've heard from a bunch of people like, hey, I went and bought that book. I'm excited to read Bovink. It's great.
Yes.
So here we go. We're diving in. Last time around, we just introduced who is Herman Bovink. This time, we're diving into chapter one of his small systematic theology, The Wonderful Works of God. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to summarize the content of the chapter in about 5 minutes, just try to give you a quick flyover of what the chapter is accomplishing. And then we're going to go around the table and just talk about, hey, what stood out to you? What did you like? What was helpful or provocative or interesting, etc. So what Herman Bovink does in this chapter is to say, here's the first line. God and God alone is man's highest good. That's the point he wants to make in the chapter. To make that point, he says there are, God is the creator, and obviously every being in creation is made to find their ultimate good in God. But man is unique because there are inanimate things in the universe, there are non-rational creatures in the universe, there are animals like your dog that have life in them, but not a rational kind of existence. And yet man is unique because we are made in God's image and likeness. And so we have this longing to know ultimate reality. We have this sense of the divine. In fact, he uses this Latin phrase, desiderium.
Can I get a classical student in here?
Thank you. Someone who reads Latin, read this. Desiderium eternitatis, which means eternal desire. He's talking about the yearning for the eternal. And he's saying this is present in human beings. And that's why we have this sense that there is something higher, something bigger that we are made to know and understand. And Bovink says that obviously is God. In this chapter, he is following both John Calvin and St. Augustine, who both sort of begin their work in theology by saying human beings are made for God. You might remember that famous line of Augustine. In fact, Bovink will quote it at the end of the chapter. Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. So that's the case he's making. Now, here's what I like what the Bovink does in the middle of chapter one. He says, hey, there are many who are perfectly willing to grant this so long as only sensuous pleasures and earthly treasures are involved. They readily acknowledge that such things cannot satisfy man and do not correspond to his high destiny. But they judge quite differently when the so-called ideal values, science, art, culture, the service of the true, the good, and the beautiful, living for others, and the aspiration to serve humanity, enter into the picture. So he's saying, hey, here's the objection. I see him working in the tradition of Thomas Aquinas here. If you're familiar with how Aquinas did theology, he would say, here's my point that I want to make. And then he would say, here's a bunch of counterarguments you might make. And then he would try to sort of answer each of those. And so what Bovink is saying is, hey, here's my primary point. God is man's highest good. And then he's going to say, here's an objection to that. You might say, no, God is not man's highest good. Man can rise to a higher sense of existence through art, through science, through learning, through these ultimate ideals that drive humanity. And so we can agree that human beings are higher than animals and ask deeper and more existential questions than animals. And yet where we're meant to find fulfillment is in things like art and music and these kinds of things in society. Bovink goes on to say, these things are in fact quite good and they reveal God to us in various ways. The problem is that they create disillusionment when you chase after them. When you try to find ultimate meaning and ultimate knowledge and ultimate life in things like art, things like humanitarian longings and inclinations, these things disillusion us. You can chase after that and think that's what's going to satisfy you and sort of fulfill that deep longing in you. But the old disillusionment enters in. Here's a quote about art. Art cannot close the gulf between the ideal and the real. It cannot make the yonder of its vision the here of our present world. It shows us the glory of Canaan from a distance, but it does not usher us into the better country nor make us citizens of it. He's saying, yes, art is a way of humans expressing ideals and looking for an existence that we don't have. The problem is it can't get us there. And so he basically overcomes this objection by saying all of these things, humanitarian influence, art, music, science, all these sort of high and noble pursuits that human beings can give themselves to, ultimately fall short of satisfying this longing that we have. And so here's how he concludes his chapter. The conclusion, therefore, is that of Augustine, who said that the heart of man was created for God and that it cannot find rest until it rests in his Father's heart. Hence, all men really are seeking after God, as Augustine also declared, but they do not all seek him in the right way, nor at the right place. And so that's his conclusion, is everyone seeks God. They're not seeking him in the right way or in the right place. And so we end up frustrated. We end up discontent. We end up dissatisfied and disillusioned until we discover that all of this yearning and longing is meant to bring us to our highest good and to find its great fulfillment in God. He also concludes by mentioning Pascal, who points out both the greatness and the miserableness of man. And I think as I read this chapter, this is the thing that grabbed hold of me, because this is the reason I'm a Christian. This is the thing that compels me about the Christian worldview. Pascal said, you have to be able to explain both man's greatness and his misery. And Bovink concludes chapter one this way: science cannot explain this contradiction in man. It reckons only with his greatness and not with his misery, or only with his misery and not with his greatness. But the scriptures know of both, and the contradictions are reconciled, the mists are cleared, and the hidden things are revealed. Man is an enigma whose solution can be found only in God. End of chapter one.
Man.
Yeah.
So good.
Good yeah. stuff.
So good. I think one of the things that I appreciate about this chapter is how he critiques the things such as science and knowledge and learning and art without degrading them.
Yes.
Yeah.
He exalts them for the good that they are and really the experience in them and the ways that they can actually help us to understand God, but at the same time has no issue pointing out their limitations. And that is a unique balance, a tightrope to walk. I mean, just in writing, but also just in posture and attitude, it's very easy for us to kind of swing one way or the other, where it just seems like this exaltation of these things because we really want to show the importance of them, or the degrading of these. But man, few writers can kind of hold these things up as a good, but also, you know, poke holes in their limitation and you not walk away thinking, well, I got to downplay all those things.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of that, because here's something he does that I do not hear many evangelicals do. He talks about the good of humanitarianism.
Yeah.
I'm going to read a quote from page 5. When we compare how the poor and the sick, the miserable and the destitute, the widows and the orphans, the insane and the imprisoned were frequently dealt with in former ages, with the way in which they are very generally treated now, we certainly have cause for happiness and gratitude.
Yeah.
A spirit of tenderness and mercy has come up, which seeks out the lost and has compassion upon the oppressed. So he's saying, man, humanitarian, what a great thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But right alongside of this, our present time shows us such a fearful pageantry of gruesome vice, of mammonism, prostitution, alcoholism, and like abominations, that we are embarrassed to answer the question whether we are moving forwards or backwards. At one moment, we are optimistic, but the next, we are plunged into deep pessimism again.
Man, sounds very, very modern. I mean, our yeah. day, like yeah. exact, say the exact same thing.
When did he write this again?
1907.
That's right. Is that right?
Yep.
So over 100 years ago,
yeah.
nailing it on the head still.
All right, what was some of the things that stood out to you or that you appreciated as you read?
I really appreciated the comments on art. Mostly the line where he says on page 5, art in all of its works and ways conjures up an ideal world before us. When I read that, I was like, oh, that's probably why I've never been really into art. I've actually always kind of felt bad that I haven't been into art like a bunch of other people are. And it's because of I come to art with more of a like, yeah, let me kind of not poke holes in that, but my experience is always different. Mm. And so I've always kind of forced myself to appreciate art. And one of the times that I remember doing that was in Paris when I was at the Louvre and all these places. And I was like, this is really important stuff when it comes to the world of art. And I'm going to make myself figure out how to appreciate it in this moment. But his lines about the ideal, that resonated with me. He goes on to say, because art thus paints for us a picture of an other and higher reality, it is a comfort in our life. It lifts the soul up out of consternation and fills our hearts with hope and joy, which art tends to do that for us. I remember seeing some gals, even just here at our church and in our gallery, spending a long time looking at the art that we had on display. And then I went and like did something. I think I had a whole like pastoral appointment. Like it was like an hour and 15 minutes long or something. And I came back and I noticed that they were still there. And I'm like, yeah, not me. Like I'm in and out of there because it is ideal. And I tend to live in the more like tangible messiness. That's not real is kind of how I'm looking at art all the time. So that was, I appreciated those lines.
Bob, I appreciated his close the most as well. They're on page 6 and 7. What I love about his writing so far is that he's very poetic. He's not just giving out facts, but he's kind of leaning into the beautiful use of words, and that pulls me in a unique way. His ending about really the solution to that we can find the answer to all the messiness and all the good is really in God. Reminded me of Psalm 73, where the psalmist says in verse 16 and 17, but when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task, which is how I feel when I ponder all the messiness and also the good in the world. Verse 17, until I went to the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. It was just a worshipful reminder that when I'm stuck in the tension in the messiness of life, really only in the presence of God and with His Word can I find the solution to all that stuff.
I was amazed by how he describes the falling short of humanitarianism, because he does it in a way that makes me say, "Oh, that's exactly what I experience." Because I think we have, like, especially when you're younger, you tend to have a more high-minded idealism of like, man, let's just make the world a better place. What's keeping us from that? Why are these old people so freaking cynical? And you know, like, let's work on it. And here's how Bovink describes the way that humanitarianism sort of runs out of gas. Listen to this. The love for one's neighbor is not a self-vindicating thing, which comes up spontaneously and naturally out of the human heart. It is a feeling and an action and a service which require tremendous willpower and which must be constantly maintained against the formidable forces of self-concern and of self-interest. Moreover, such love of the neighbor frequently gets little support from the neighbor himself. People generally are not so lovable that we should naturally, without exertion and struggle, cherish them and love them as we do ourselves. Indeed, the love for the neighbor can maintain itself only if, on the one hand, it is based on and laid upon us by the law of God, and only if, on the other hand, that same God grants us the desire to live uprightly according to all His commandments. When I read that, I was like, that's exactly how loving my neighbor feels. It feels like, yeah, this is really hard apart from the grace of God and the empowering of the Spirit.
Yeah, genuinely loving, not the performative kind that we see on social media and, you know, kind of more in...
And it frequently gets little support from the neighbor himself.
Yeah,
Chris.
That part, oh man, it's so true.
That like, is true.
I want to help you more than you want to be helped in some ways. But, and this too, again, the brilliance of this chapter is he captures so well the contradiction in man that just reveals our absolute brokenness and sin and need for God. And that anything that is self-defining, self-determining will always come up short. But at the same time, that sin, that brokenness does not minimize the image of God and the uniqueness of man and the great capacity that God has put into us as people made in his image. And so Bob Hink is at once totally honest about sin, but so life-affirming and humanity-affirming. Mm-hmm. There's just that is just, again, an incredibly difficult line to walk with sincerity. It doesn't feel put on at all. It feels very genuine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love on page two how he's wrestling out that how we're made in the image of God and all those broken parts, the true and the good and the beautiful, those things that aren't whole in us can only be found, can only be made whole in him. He talks about it, the divine truth, the divine goodness. Those things, we, you know, that wholeness that we're missing can only be found in him. I loved how he plays that out there at the beginning of the chapter.
You got something, Travis?
Every time I read these kinds of books, I'm always like, you know, bringing my own experiences of like what I'm going through at that time. And as I was reading this, I've been preparing a lesson for student ministry on the image of God. And so a lot of his thoughts on like what makes man different from the rest of creation, whether that be like rationality or like emotions or, you know, consciousness, all this different stuff. I love that. Because a lot of people will try and make like the image of God, like, oh, it's our ability to, you know, higher thinking or, you know, our capacity to create things, you know, all these different things. And the way that he points it to is like, no, the thing that makes us different is that we are not satisfied by the things that are around us. We're not satisfied by tasty pretzels that are covered in dark chocolate. Like we want something higher, better, that is beyond our grasp. And that is only fulfilled in God. And like, that is unlike any other creature in all of creation. And I don't know, the way that he highlights that is just really refreshing to rather than be like, oh, this is like the faculties that man has. It's like, no, it's this desire that we have, kind of like what C.S. Lewis talks about of there's a desire that we can't fulfill anywhere here on earth. Therefore, there must be something beyond. But he's kind of reversing it, but not just that therefore there must be a God. It's like, oh, therefore, we must be different than everything else because I don't see, you know.
Your dog doesn't have that longing.
Exactly.
Here's a place, an example of why Bob Hink, I think, is wise beyond his time. One of the big questions and discussions in neuroscience right now in the modern day is, where's the line between brain and mind? What is the difference between brain and mind? Brain meaning biology, you know, your brain. You can do brain studies and brain scans and say, oh, when you're attracted to someone, this part of your brain fires up, or when you're hungry, this part of your brain fires up, or when you use language, this part, you know. And so everybody's very right now into studying the brain and why the brain responds and thinks the things it does. But everybody is also aware that there seems to be this mind which is beyond the biological functioning of the brain. Like they can't isolate in your brain, where is your concept that you are a unique being in distinction from other beings, right? Like there's certain things that are these higher thoughts, these ideas that don't seem to map cleanly onto brain chemistry. And so this question is very live in neuroscience. What's the distinction between brain and mind? Here's what Bob Hink says 114 years ago. Man's thinking and knowing, although bound to his brain, are nevertheless in their essence quite entirely a spiritual activity, far transcending the things he sees with his eye and handles with his hand. By means of such thought, he establishes his connection with a world which he cannot see and touch, but which is just as actual and which possesses more of essential reality than does the corporeality of the earth. What he is really seeking for is not a tangible reality, but a spiritual truth. He's saying the fact that you think about things that are beyond the embodied corporeal realities of earth is a sign, as Travis was just saying, that you are made to find your life and good in something beyond this physical world.
Pastors in the room, you three guys leading and shepherding your churches, what's a pastoral nugget or burden that you feel for your people when you read a chapter like this?
I feel the same thing that led me to plant Cormdale Church, which is this sense of he's talking about deep realities that every human being knows are true deep down. And it's that Pascal thing of if we can reckon with the greatness of human beings and the misery of human beings and ask, how do we explain both? I want every Christian to have that kind of category, that this is what the gospel does. This is what the scriptures do, is they give us an explanation of how human beings can be both great and in misery at the same time. And so my longing is for Christians to have those categories in their minds, because I think they enable us to have really good conversations with people in our lives who are asking some of those kinds of questions. Hey, how do I explain that, why I'm so drawn to this musician or this piece of art? Or how do I explain this kind of suffering or hardship in the world?
And it's kind of your vision for Coram Deo to be a context where people can ask those questions and wrestle those things out, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Along those same lines, for me, it certainly is this a pastoral encouragement towards the embracing of the both and, the all of life. And so God in his providence has ordained that we would walk through suffering and sin as a pathway to knowing him, I mean, through redemption, through Jesus Christ. So there is a sense where our suffering and the experience of sin, while that is broken and we don't want to like celebrate that, there is a sense too where that is part of life and the way God has ordained it. And so too often, I think we just try to create this strong dichotomy, create this either or, and we cut off the ways that the fullness of experiencing God is through these so-called contradictions, that it is in our weakness and our sin, the grace of God meets us and we experience him. And then it's also in the greatness that God has put into us that we experience these wonderful gifts of what it means to be human and being able to use our humanity to the glory of God and to really start what started in the garden and cultivating this incredibly complex, mysterious, beautiful world. And man, if we just dive straight into all of that instead of trying to cut parts of that off, what a richer experience of God we will have in life.
As I was reading this chapter, I kept thinking about desire, because we know that Bob Inc is pretty influenced by Augustine, right? And so I had that in the back of my mind, along with some of James K. Smith's stuff on Augustine. And I found myself, Mike, to answer your question, I found myself wanting people's desires to align with God's desires. And I, even just sitting here, hashing it up again, I think my pastoral burden is, you're created and designed to want God, but you have to align those desires to want God at the same time. You have to exert yourself, will yourself, you have to do some work to realign your desire. Because at the end of the day, to quote Bob Inc, the temporal order cannot satisfy man. And that's the culture. That's what I also feel like Christians have bought into a little bit. Like it's kind of, it goes back to Christianity being more than a worldview. I found myself drawn to that desire language, and you can just smell it in Bob Inc, in his writing in this chapter for sure.
Well, next time, next month, we're going to be on chapter 2. So read ahead, folks. Get this book, read ahead. And if you have any thoughts or any questions you'd like us to tackle, send those to us at podcast@cdomaha.com. The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, thank you for listening in. And we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. And we'll see you again next Wednesday for another Wednesday conversation.